Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Political Football, the podcast that digs into the global political stories behind the sport. I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman.
And I'm John Bew, a contributing writer at The New Statesman. This is a special series devoted to the 2018 World Cup. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be following all the action in Russia as it continues and analysing it with our guests.
I'm delighted today that we're joined by our first woman on the podcast. We're joined by Alison McGovern.
Hello.
The excellent Labour MP, but also renowned podcaster. You're on the Anfield Wrap podcast, aren't you?
That's right. I have the great joy of sometimes talking about Liverpool Football Club, which is a lot of fun. It's more fun than being on Radio 4, I have to be honest.
I can imagine. And Stephen Bush, my co-presenter, is actually in Cornwall. He's gone chasing the sunshine in the southwest. And John, you were on our first programme, so welcome back. I think we'll start, we're going to talk about England. I think we'll talk about Argentina, what's going wrong there. Ali's a big Liverpool fan, so she's going to talk about Mo Salah and the North African clubs, and what teams, I should say, rather than clubs, and what's been happening at their World Cup. And I thought we might do a little bit of Balkan politics, Xhaka, etc. So, John, England, how's it going?
They look pretty good. When I say this as a Northern Irishman, so when I watched the Swiss team, I realised that they're the team that beat us in the playoffs just before the tournament. And I think we could have quite happily taken on Brazil and these other teams. So I just wanted to put that in there before before we moved on to England. England should have won these two games. And in fact, if you look at the level of the teams, they should be winning 6-1. But there's a kind of something's been liberated in the kind of England mentality. They did clearly less pressure. There's a bit more fluency. I still think there are certain weaknesses if you're being hyper picky, the way the back three sometimes give away the ball. But the fluidity, the confidence and sense of momentum is all quite impressive. And this leads to the dilemma as to what to do in the Belgium game, whether to push through, beat the Belgians, and then a draw gets England through on a better disciplinary record.
And enter as group winners.
And enter a tougher side of the draw, actually. I suspect the smart move is to continue with momentum, play a strong team, keep those players fresh and confident, because one can be too clever at World Cups.
There's a lot of younger players. There's a lot of surprises. Raheem Sterling, you know, somebody who's... he's won the Premier League, right? So he's not that upset about it. But his career's been a bit up and down, and he finally seems to be catching a break.
Hasn't scored yet, though. He's got a terrible goal-scoring record for England.
No, but I think from a point of view of his contribution to the team, I think he's not getting any grief in the way that he has done previously.
Yeah.
He had this amazing article on the Players' Tribune where he was able to talk openly and actually really... fluently
about
what he'd been through,
working with his mother,
you know. Yeah. I think everyone was quite surprised by that. Then there's the surprise of Loftus-Cheek as well. Like, I think one of the things that's been really good about England so far has been it's been a little bit unexpected. Gareth Southgate turns out to be a footballing genius. Who knew? I mean, that's getting
genius
ahead of ourselves.
But what I like about him, he's got
it under control. Yeah. We feel reassured by Gareth Southgate. I don't think I've ever felt so confident in an England manager?
A few things to say about the culture around the camp. First of all, noticeably, there's less fuss around the wags, so-called. They were spotted in and around the stadium. Also, there's lots of great photos of Harry Kane's family just sitting with the fans. And Southgate said after the game, he let them have a few beers and put the music on. So it's kind of a more relaxed atmosphere. Just one thing I've spotted, for the first time in my memory, every single England player singing the national anthem. And I wonder if Gareth Southgate, who says he's intensely patriotic and has this, his grandfather who is a Marine, and I wonder if he's just had a quiet word or just asked a few players why they didn't sing the national anthem. It's an odd kind of moment. I don't know if that tells us anything.
Well, I think firstly, I mean, on the so-called WAG stands for women and girlfriends, right? It's not something even more derogatory than that. But I think, you know, women have collectively decided that ain't our role in football anymore. And the second thing is on patriotism, I think there was a kind of negativity about England and there doesn't need to be, you know, and I think that's what Southgate has, as John says, has done pretty well. Like,
so we spoke about this last week. It's the old connotations of the flag, the St. George's flag, the cross, the 1970s when there was a hardcore hooligan faction that followed the England team. What you're seeing, Ali, is a different kind of Englishness represented by Southgate and the team this time around.
I think it's a bunch of people saying, you know what, that's my flag too. You know, I'm English and I'm not a part of that culture that pervaded before. This is a new way of being English and we're going to be really proud of it. And I think that's a good thing.
There are less fans there, I will say that. So the less England fans who travel, an estimated basically a sixth of what normally travels. And if you look at the Colombia game the other day, they basically filled half the stadium. And if you see the England game, there was pockets of England fans dotted around.
I think before the tournament, there was a lot of unease about, of course, the tournament being held in Putin's Russia, you know, this rather grim authoritarian state. And also what happened in Marseille during the Euros when the English fans were attacked by supposedly Russian hooligan ultras, but they looked more like a paramilitaries. I mean, it looked like us kind of, who knows what was the background behind this attack on England fans. They were meant to be Locomotive Moscow ultras, but the way they worked and mobilised, they were stone cold sober. They looked like a paramilitary force hitting England fans.
Who knows what's really gone on? And obviously from the outside, it's impossible to tell what's really going on there. And as John says, we've got fewer people out there and the consequences of the political situation obviously mean there's, you know, there aren't a lot of dignitaries going either. So it's pretty hard to tell. Also, the politics, you know, I think we'll probably talk about it, but the politics keeps breaking out despite best efforts to just concentrate on the sport.
Boris Johnson said before the tournament, didn't he? I mean, he's a clownish figure, we know. But before the tournament, he said Putin would use the World Cup as Hitler used the 1936 Olympics for aggressive displays of nationalism. That hasn't happened, has it?
Thankfully not, no. I think the impression you get is more people focused on the sport and the diversity of the sport. But I think it is difficult. I think, you know, whether it's events that are happening on the pitch, we keep seeing these flashes of politics, or whether it's the fact that people around the world are like saying, well, hang on, how can we forget about what's going on in Syria? You know, just this week we've had hospitals and medical staff attacked again. So I think, honestly, I think those participating have kind of just got to get through it, hopefully safely and in a way that demonstrates the best of the sport. And then, fingers crossed, FIFA and UEFA move on and realise the error in terms of actually the staging of these games and try and do better in the future.
You said in the first podcast, John, that you in some ways, although you were sceptical of the Russian state, nevertheless, you embraced Russia as a great football nation. Are we seeing this embrace working?
Look, it's a complex place. And where England played their last game, Southgate went to the War Memorial there. And there's a kind of a more of a sense that, you know, the Marseille version of Russia abroad, these sort of thuggish hooligans sent with apparent blessing of the state, is actually different than Russia itself. And you've seen that. The atmosphere seems to be pretty impressive. There seems to be very little trouble. One wonders how that's through sort of robust policing and other things. I mean, you've got to say, whatever you think of Putin's state, it actually has been a kind of a good World Cup for all the things you want to avoid.
We shouldn't fail to differentiate between Putin's, you know, government and the Russian people.
Oh, quite right.
You know, I think that's what I take from this World Cup. I reserve the right to be absolutely critical of what that regime has done whilst embracing Russian people and their contribution to the world.
Agreed. And one good thing is I can barely think of a time where I've seen Putin, actually. He hasn't been frontispiece, so someone maybe had a word.
Yeah, he was there at the first Russia match against the Saudis when they thrashed Saudi Arabia 5-0, and he was sitting alongside MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the the Saudi, the young supposed reforming Saudi autocrat. Is that a oxymoron or mixed metaphor? What is it? Can you be a reforming autocrat?
That's exactly what it is. It's an enlightened despot.
An enlightened despot.
A contradiction in terms.
As opposed to an unenlightened despot. And before we leave England, I mean, I do like Southgate. I return to him every week. And looking at the way people are writing about him now, he's being written about almost as if he's a kind of style icon. You spoke about him as a genius. Others are saying he's the best dressed guy in the tournament.
I think my enthusiasm slightly gets the better of me. I just think he'd obviously clocked that a lot of what was going on was in the players' heads. I mean, football is a sport best played in the mind, right? It's like they had all of this pressure and no reservoir of confidence to get themselves through it. And I think clearly Southgate has done something up at St George's Park where they've built a level of confidence in each other. They trust the people around the England team. And then Southgate has dealt with the media in, frankly, a very savvy way. I mean, we think back to the horror days of, you know, previous managers who were just like all mouth. Southgate seems to be much more focused on delivering and then being calm with the media and saying, look, this is my plan, you know, and frankly was quite robust with the media actually about their what they'd done in terms of leaking the team and saying, look, you can either choose to help us or not.
Well, that was good journalistic practice. I mean, there was a team sheet, it was photographed, and of course, you know, as an editor in London, I would have wanted my reporters to get that out, wouldn't you?
Really?
I would. We know it's like politicians, Ali, forgive me, but we're not here to cheerlead. You know, we're here to offer sometimes the Labour Party friendly but sceptical commentary.
Me and Gareth Southgate versus the journos, eh?
And John, Ali used the word plan. I mean, they also looked organised on the pitch. I like the way England line up at set pieces. I like the fluidity in the team. It looks like they're well coached.
I think they're well coached. I mean, you English never fail to amaze me. We're the Celtic fringe is supposed to be the sort of hyperactive, emotional ones. But when it comes to football, suddenly this narrative starts to creep and you get, you know, even sort of sober sports writers writing this morning about this sort of Southgate genius. This bandwagon is emerging. I think what you can give him credit for is precisely that. Team is well coached. They've been given a kind of an identity, although as we discussed in the first podcast, some of that's slightly accidental and they fell upon the formation, which is a re-up version of Terry Venables' Christmas tree. And he has the players for it. He's got younger players, fitter players, I think, in previous World Cups, the side of a kind of asthmatic and 60 game Paul Scholes struggling in the sun. I mean, I suppose he was my favourite ever player, but this is it's a very highly athletic team, some of whom haven't played the full season as well, and you've got people like Rashford, you know,
Lingard.
Desperate to get
the pitch. Lingard, he's hit another. A vein of form
exactly.
Just at the right time,
and there's no fitness issues sort of playing, you know, unfit players, all that type of thing. So there's an element of luck with that. What you can give him credit for, and he's been around the FA setup for the last 5-6 years, he's been a disciple for a more sophisticated version of the game at county level, at youth level as well. So he's had an influence on the kind of British, English football hierarchy across the piece.
Some of the young players that he's nurtured from when he was under 21 coach, Lingard. He brought Lingard into the squad. Loftus-Cheek. He knows these players. Before we leave, there was that wonderful 25-pass goal that led to Harry Kane's sixth against Panama. It broke the record of passes, which was held by the Argentinian side in 2006 against Serbia when they beat Serbia 6-0. I was actually at the game in Gelsenkirchen in Germany, Schalke Stadium, when it was like a symphony of collaboration and Cambiasso swept the ball into the goal after a 24-pass move with Raquel May, the Argentinian playmaker, sitting deep and orchestrating the move. England's goal, by contrast, although it was a wonderful symphony of passing, it ended with an inadvertent backheel from Harry Kane, which is what I thought was a wonderfully comic moment. It's a typical England moment. We can't complete a wonderful goal in the way that Argentinian did, but it's optimistic. Let's not get overexcited.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns. Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What's going on, John, with Argentina?
I mean, they're struggling again. They've had a reprieve because of all the results have fallen their way. So, you know, they have a chance to go through. And I still think they might go through. I mean, I think people get overhyped about the sort of criticism of Messi and the constant comparison with Ronaldo. The team is not built around him. International football is different than La Liga. There's a kind of a lack of fluidity. There's perhaps too many players a little bit similar to Messi in that team. And you see him kind of constantly dropping deep.
They look demoralised, John.
Events off the pitch, it's really difficult. I think there is a narrative here of some of the the big teams in previous World Cups, you know, look at Germany and others having underperformed, but like football always does, you know, I think they'll be all right in the end. It's a bit like the Arsenal story, you know, they kind of like have a bit of a crisis, everything's all a bit difficult, but they kind of make it through because actually there is a lot of quality in the Argentina squad in the end. Yeah, but, you know, there's a lot of teams lower down that would, you know, absolutely crave such a position, and the same is true here. I think Argentina will probably, I think they'll probably get through.
They've almost got too much talent. I mean, on the bench against the defeat against Croatia, the 3-0 defeat, they had Higuain on the bench, Di Maria, Dybala from Juventus.
They've got a similar type of talent, which is kind of a diminutive attacker. So they're kind of monodimensional when they go forward, and it has to be fluent or it's inefficient. And also some of the kind of what Didier Deschamps was self-described as the water carriers in the team aren't as effective as they used to be. So Mascherano, who has had a dip really in the last few months, doesn't look so efficient or pacey around the team. They've got Rojo. I'm a Manchester United fan. I think Rojo's a decent centre back, but he's barely started for United all season.
And the coach, Sampaoli, is that how you pronounce it? Who speaks Spanish?
I would say Sampaoli.
He was the Chilean coach at the last World Cup. This extraordinary high energy, intensely pressing Chilean side, but that seems to be absent from the Argentinian side. They're not playing like the Chileans played 4 years ago.
Yeah, they've struggled in qualifying as well. So these aren't surprises. They released qualified through the back door in the last minute. I think back to the famous Argentine coach Daniel Passarella, if everyone remembers him, who used to make his players cut their hair short because he was kind of a sort of quite militaristic, a bit of a dictator.
He was
in that team.
Captain of the 78 Argentinian World Cup winning side,
and he refused to pick Battistuta until Battistuta cut his hair. Yeah, so I wonder if you need a kind of Passarella coming back in the team to instill a bit of discipline there.
But Sampaoli, he looks like a kind of street leader of a street gang, doesn't he? Heavily tattooed, shaven head, black V-neck t-shirt. Looks quite psychotic on the bench when he gets angry.
Yeah, I think possibly that, like, clearly there's a lot of tension. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, Jason, but clearly there's a huge amount of tension. I mean, people were like reporting that like Messi's mother had been in floods of tears over it. And I think it's obviously for, you know, many of the South American sides, this is absolutely everything. There was a really interesting conversation about all of the players like speaking out a bit more fully. And I forget which one of the South American kind of players who was commentating was talking just about how much pressure there is on players. And Argentina is absolutely like that, where, you know, so much hope is invested in this side. And clearly when it doesn't go well, people understand what is going on back home. They understand the ramifications when they get home. And I think for Messi, you know, to imagine being him taking all this pressure. He's like the lightning rod.
Yeah. But he takes pressure because he leads Barcelona so wonderfully. But, you know, Ronaldo scored five times at this tournament. Harry Kane has scored five times. Lukaku scored four times. Messi hasn't scored.
I think it does matter to him. He's also retired from international football on more than one occasion. So he does get sort of...
So there must be a reason why he keeps coming back.
Yeah.
He must really want this.
But they say in Argentina, to be a true great, to stand alongside Pelé or Maradona, you have to almost metaphorically lead your country to a World Cup, you know, as Maradona did in 1986 for Argentina. And Messi hasn't done that. I mean, they got to the final 4 years ago and he had a very mediocre performance in the final against Germany. But is Ali right? Is the pressure too great on him?
Yeah, when you compare that achievement to a much lesser team, Ronaldo, at least dragging Portugal to the final of the Euros, even though he came off injured after a few minutes. And he did kind of give them that belief. And so you can say on that metric, I mean, these are absurd comparisons in the sense that, you know, these two are by far the greatest Ronaldo and Messi the world has ever seen.
Yeah. Like, who decided that that was the test? Like, that you have to have led your country to a World Cup.
Yeah.
But clearly, for some countries, that is the judgment.
And there is Maradona sitting up in the stands watching. He was
like a constant presence.
Constant presence, weeping at the end of the game as Argentina ever humiliated. You've got to say something about Croatia. I mean, one of my favourite players is Luka Modric, even though he's a former Spurs player. What a player.
Wonderful footballer, completely underrated. I think Jamie Redknapp doesn't speak a lot of sense, but he did say Modric is the best midfielder at the World Cup. And if you look at Modric and Rakitic in the centre of the Croatian midfield versus the Barcelona-Real Madrid comparison that Brazil have, so they've got Paulinho and Casemiro sitting in there, that Croatia are better for that reason. So technical ability, there's Perisic as well, there's fight and hunger. They're actually fantastic to watch, actually one of my favourite teams. Only second in terms of entertainment value to Colombia. But they, you know, they look actually
really
effective.
You love that Colombian win the other night, didn't you, John?
It's absolutely brilliant. My favourite sort of screenshot of the World Cup so far is Reni Higuita in the stands with Carlos Valderrama and then this wonderful, you know, busy, self-confident Colombian attacking football. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And you have players, you know, in some cases don't impress me that much, like James Rodriguez. Absolutely fantastic, you know, sort of tricks and flicks.
Or playing out their skin and the crowd kicking absolutely every ball.
Exactly, right? And the Colombians seem to take over that stadium. They kind of run over the locals.
Up in the stands like a sort of aged nightclub. frequenter.
It was absolutely brilliant.
Long, curly, bleached hair.
I did feel for a moment I was sort of back in the 70s. I really enjoyed it.
They're wonderful to watch, although they lost their first game, so they're vulnerable.
Oh, they're absolutely vulnerable. They're sort of madcap. They're either 100% or nothing. I think that's the difficulty. But they'd be kind of dark horses now. Uruguay have also performed well as another South American team. So there are, you know, they're exciting.
A slow start, though.
They did have a slow start. I think we're building towards every World Cup has that great European South American clash, and you know, there are a few potentially on the horizon, possibly England Brazil
or England Colombia in the last 16. Yeah. It depends how the groups finish.
That would be a mad game, wouldn't it?
Mad game,
brilliant.
You're a big Liverpool fan. And
we were all very excited about the Suarez Salah kind of, but it didn't really come.
What happened to Salah this World Cup? You think?
So it's difficult, like. I think, obviously, coming out of the European Cup final and the absolute tragedy.
With his injury.
Yeah, I think that was a really, really difficult backdrop from which to come to the World Cup. Even though, actually, it has to be said that, like, I think there was mainly, within that Liverpool side, just a lot of, like, appreciation of the brilliant football. We'd lost Oxlade-Chamberlain, and so we hadn't had the best preparation for the final. So it wasn't really all on Salah. But it can't have been easy. I mean, imagine having that happen to you and then knowing that you're going to the World Cup with the hopes of your country on your shoulders, where Egypt has kind of like broken out into this absolute adoration of Mo Salah in a very understandable way. He's a marvellous footballer against a very, very difficult political, economic situation there. And Salah's kind of beautiful player, and we've seen flashes of it, but really hasn't materialized. And then he's unfortunately had this slightly difficult political situation.
What is that?
So he seems to have, the team were based in Grozny, and he seems to have met the leader of the Chechnya there, and
who's a virulent homophobe.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's really difficult to be a player. And to understand how you're supposed to respond to such a political situation. There seems to be some debate within the Egypt camp about whose fault it was and whether it was agreed. Meanwhile, you know, I think the rest of the team are not really supporting Salah, and I think it's a bit of an impossible situation for him. I think, you know, I sort of thought before the World Cup, maybe Egypt, possibly the Iranians, we might see some flashes. I can remember, you know, previously when African teams really broke through into the World Cup for the first time.
You were hoping maybe a North African side or a Middle Eastern side, or indeed one of the sub-Saharan African sides.
Yeah.
Senegal are still playing well.
Mane, to talk of another Liverpool player, scored in the 1-1 draw that they had. I think, you know, they're doing okay. I think the reality is it is difficult, as we were saying before. I think the politics does keep breaking through, despite everybody's attempt to say, let's just talk about the footballers. For Salah, you know, he's had this incredible year that hasn't ended very well, and you just hope he can go on. For the other sides, I mean, Saudi Arabia as well have played fairly well.
And they beat Egypt. I missed the game last night, but they beat Egypt 2-1. I mean, it's been disappointing, particularly for the North African sides.
Yeah.
Tunisia were poor. Morocco were better. They obviously got
Morocco a decent side. It's not the best Egypt team. There have been better Egyptian teams. They have the best player they've had, you know, possibly ever, but it's not the best Egyptian team. In fact, if you go back to the first podcast, you'll find I did predict that Russia would comfortably beat them and they wouldn't go through. So I'm feeling vindicated on that. And there's a lot of pressure on Salah. I mean, he's still done what he can. Didn't play in the first game. He has scored a goal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't really, you've got a goal a game record. So, you know, it's unfair to put too much on Salah in the sense that it's for Messi surrounded by Aguero, Mascherano, Di Maria, all these other players. It's, you know, there's no Egyptian household names beyond.
The great El Neni, as Stephen Bush calls him, the Arsenal midfielder.
Yeah, I mean, El Neni, again, has looked a bit, he's not the great El Neni, that's the problem.
Yeah. I think Stephen's being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talk about politics keep breaking out at this World Cup, and this is political football after all, and we are the new statesmen. I liked the moment in the Swiss-Serbia game, 2-1 to Switzerland, when Xhaka and Shaqiri, but both familiar from, and you smiled then when I pronounced Shaqiri, I think correctly, at least I hope I did.
Tick in the box.
Apologies if I didn't. Familiar to us from the Premier League, celebrated their goals, each of them scored a goal, by making the sign of an Albanian eagle against Serbia, which clearly was a gesture to the turbulence of the Balkans, John. What do you think was going on there?
Yeah, so they're from Kosovar families, as far as I understand.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a kind of probably satisfying moment when they both scored the two goals that beat Serbia. I mean, it's a big debate that they face sort of retrospective punishment in this, and there's a big debate as to political symbols and football. I mean, I think it's probably wise to keep those political symbols out of football as much as you possibly can, because then you end up in a kind of which symbol is virtuous versus which symbol is provocative. And I think of Paul Gascoigne's flute, playing the orange flute to Celtic fans in the Old Firm games back in the day. So, you know, where do you draw the line? It's the one, you know.
He had death threats.
He did have death threats thereafter. So I think it's sad.
Pep Guardiola, you know, having worn his ribbon.
For Catalonia.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I think John's probably right. I think my viewpoint would be, though, sometimes you can't stop it.
I think some
of those players would say, but this is who I am, this is everything about me, and I can't pretend to not be who I am. I think Guardiola has basically expressed those sentiments. And I think Shaqiri also had a Kosovo flag on his boot.
He was actually born in Kosovo,
yeah.
Unlike Xhaka, whose parents were.
Yeah, and whilst, of course, I think politics in general, you have to be really careful and just focus on the sport. And if there is a message from this World Cup, actually, it's about the fact that football is that game that is the universal language. Everybody can, you know, communicate with each other via it. And I think that's a very positive message. But I think that's got to be matched with a realism about some of these countries are engaged in very difficult political situations. And the idea that we can just ignore that is probably not
Serbia
right.
Hasn't acknowledged or the so-called independence of Kosovo. There's a Serbian enclave within Kosovo. There's still quite a sizable Serbian population. You as a historian, John, know well the history of Serbia. A famous battle was fought there in the 14th century. The Serbs see this as their kind of ancestral lands, what the Kosovans would recognise as their own land. So it's very, very contentious.
Yeah, I mean, you could write a really brilliant history on the breakup of football history on the breakup of Yugoslavia. You think about the teams that are, you know, the players that come out of that portion of Europe, the technical ability, the flair. The identity expressed through football. Croatian national team is a prime example of that. Serbians again, you know, the deep sort of skeins of national pride which run through their team and that sort of self identity. And you know, in some ways, we regard ourselves as slightly post-nationalist and sneering about these things. Actually, it's, you know, in some cases, actually quite an impressive cohesive thing. In other places, it's there are ugly legacies thereof. Unsurprisingly, this is more than a kind of minor conflict. This is a, you know, deep civil war in which tens of thousands of people died in our recent memory. So, you know,
and a diaspora, hence the Kosovans in Switzerland. But also, if you think back to that great Red Star Belgrade side, which won the old European Cup just before the Balkan Wars erupted, that Red Star team had Macedonians in it, Darko Pančev up front. It had Prozaneki, the great Croatian playmaker in the midfield, Savicevic, the Serb. I mean, it was a reflection of the old Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah.
Lost.
Yeah, and we're seeing now a new generation of those who would have been small children or the children of people who were born into a family that had fled. And so I think it's really interesting how that's being reflected, perhaps in not so much of a kind of, I think lots of people, when they're in that conflict, they would maybe want to forget about it. But actually some of those next generations are saying, okay, well, I want to express my identity and I don't want to hide it. And I think it is a challenge for football to get some of these debates right. I think it's a challenge for those who are in the running of the game to say, okay, we play a sport that's based on national identity, so we are necessarily going to have to deal with these questions. It's going to sound like I'm completely obsessed with Liverpool Football Club, which I am, but our lovely Dejan Lovren made a documentary a couple of years ago, also part of the brilliant Croatia team, about being a refugee. And has like addressed this question of identity in quite an intellectual and smart way, but nonetheless felt that he needed to do it. And I think to come back to Raheem Sterling, Lukaku, and the things that they've said about the nature of their identity and having, you know, moved to a particular country, but nonetheless feeling like, I absolutely am English. I absolutely am Belgian, especially in this context of a World Cup. I think football has to work out how can we be empathetic in people's expression of national identity where otherwise there might be conflict.
Okay, Ali, I always ask my guests, and I say as if I've had hundreds of them, I haven't, this is only the third programme, as to what your tip is for the World Cup. Who's going to win?
Okay, well, I would absolutely love it if England won, but I think, I mean, can anyone beat the Belgians?
Really? So Belgium is your tip. John, are you staying with France?
Yeah, staying with France.
And I'm, as usual, withholding my prediction.
That's not fair.
So thanks again to Ali for joining us today. Also thanks to John Bew, my co-presenter. Stephen Bush, who's in Cornwall, will be back next week. You've been listening to Political Football. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can leave a review on iTunes and let's see where we are next week. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.